The last couple of weeks, I've been talking about how we share our faith with people, and so just a 3-week sermon series, which I really have never done here before. So that was a new thing for me, and this whole thing about having a brand and an image and a title—that's all new. And you can tell I kind of did it some weeks and not as much others. Two weeks ago it was the woman at the well, and so the story there as a brief recap is she told her story of what happened when she met Jesus, and then she was really quick to share that with others, and that's a story that nobody can really argue with, right? This is what happened with me when I met Jesus, and maybe you should come and meet him too. And then last week it was Paul in Athens, and the cool thing about that, this whole use of the altar to the unknown God was that he used what he knew about their history, their culture, and their religion to build a bridge when he shared the gospel, a cultural bridge, and he was relevant to the people there. And that's what I really love about him, and you see that in his entire ministry about how everything could be wrapped up in that phrase in 1 Corinthians, I became all things to all men, that I might by some means win some. And this week, we're going to go a slightly different track with how we can share our faith. So if you could, turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 5. This is a story that's in 3 of the Gospels, and so we may at times flip back and forth. If you're interested, it's Matthew 9, Mark 2, or Luke 5. I'm going to use Luke 5 as the basis for what I'm doing. And so we should have it available if we can go forward a few slides. After this, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector by the name of Levi sitting in his tax booth. "Follow me," Jesus said. And Levi got up, left everything, and followed him. So a couple of things about tax collectors. You probably, if you've been to church much, you've heard a little bit about them. But we can probably start with how, I don't know how you feel about tax collectors. I know how I feel about tax collectors. And this is a place where I hope they aren't recording. Because my thoughts about tax collectors, especially this week, because I sent my tax payments earlier, and I've got, with local stuff, I have to make quarterly payments and on some local things. Man, I hate writing those checks. And I know I've heard stories about people who work for the IRS who won't tell anybody where they work because they don't want people to think less of them. And I get why they would do that. As someone who works at the bank, I I get why people would say that. Anyway, in this case, though, the tax collectors were especially hated. So if you wanted to be a tax collector at this time, what you would do is you would actually have to bid for the right to be a tax collector. So you'd pay money to the Roman government to say, I'll collect your taxes. And the reason you'd have to bid for it is because it was a very lucrative job. In essence, you set your own salary for this job. So if I was the tax collector for Reynoldsburg, Ohio, my job would be to collect, let's say it's $1 million in 2018 from all of our good citizens. Well, I was paid. I don't have a salary coming from the Roman government for this. My salary is what I collect over $1 million. So if I think I'm worth $50,000 this year, I'm going to collect $1 million plus $50,000 for me. If I think I'm worth $500,000, I'm going to collect $1.5 million and pocket the money. That's how it was to be a tax collector at this time. And you had the backing of the Roman government and the soldiers who were with you when you told people how much money they owed. So you had to get the minimum, that's true, but everything over that, that was yours. As you might expect, the people hated these guys. They were thieves, they were liars, they were traitors. Levi, I mean, we don't know exactly what tribe the guy's from, but we can make a pretty good guess because of his name that he's actually a Levite. That was a very common practice to use family or tribe names for men. And so Think about that for a second. If this guy was a Levite, his family was supposed to be serving at the temple and be leaders of the people in purity and holiness. And this guy instead is a traitor, collecting money for the hated Romans. That's who he is. And if you notice the town they're in, it's not in the text right here, but he's in Capernaum, which is where Peter and Andrew live and where James and John live. We don't know exactly where his tax booth was, but most likely it was near the lake, because the fish that those guys caught were taxed. So whenever Andrew and Peter and James and John would catch fish, they had to go by and report to Levi what they'd caught and give him a cut. This is the guy Jesus picked. If I were to think about a person who would be reviled as much as a tax collector like this, I would say it's probably the guy who sells drugs to our junior high kids. But it's legal. So the law won't stop him. In fact, they'll help him. But that's who he is to these people, how reviled he would be, like in our culture. So I want to ask, have you ever thought that there was someone that you know that would be, they're not a Christian, but they'd be a really good Christian, right? They're a good person. They're educated, they're intelligent, they're respectful, they treat people well. If they just were a Christian, wow, they'd make a great one, right? They're already good, they just need Jesus. Have you ever thought about that? On the other hand, have you ever thought that there was someone who was the least likely person to become a follower of Jesus? You just think there's no chance. That guy, that woman, never gonna happen. When I was in Tennessee, there was a guy that we baptized, and I remember the day after he was baptized, a good friend of mine who had known this guy his whole life, went to school with him, had a lot of interactions family-wise, and I didn't know all that history. I hadn't been there that long. This guy was rough, apparently, and he had done some bad things to this friend of mine's family years ago. And they were actually there in the congregation when we baptized Chip. And they told me, we were wondering if the water was going to fly out of the baptistry when he was dunked. I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. That's Levi. That's who Jesus came for. And what's so remarkable to me about this, he didn't just say, I'm going to save Levi. I'm going to let him come to our church or be a part of our crowd. On the outside, he can sit in the back and we'll, you know, maybe, you know, we're never going to put him on stage or anything like that. No, he made him one of the 12. The inner circle. He can reach anyone. Never count anyone out. I don't know if you've ever had any thoughts like that, but if you have had thoughts like that about a person, you need to stop now. You need to repent of that now. You need to recognize that there is no one who's beyond the reach of Jesus. He chose a man that nobody wanted. And if we're going to follow our leader, we got to do that too. We got to open our hearts and our doors to people who are on the margin. The people who we would reject. Is there anybody on the margin in your life? Is there someone that you avoid because they're so obnoxious, so hopeless, so rude, disrespectful? Someone you flee? Jesus calls us to see beneath that, to see the potential, because here's what's so remarkable about this guy that was a reject, this guy who was shunned by everyone around him. Jesus saw a potential in him to change the world. And that's what Levi did. This is Matthew. He wrote one of the Gospels. He traveled around the world and saved countless people. And he died for his faith. We may look at someone and just see the bad in their lives, but Jesus, he sees this potential. And if we keep going, Levi held a great banquet for Jesus at his house, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating with them. So Levi, he's so excited about what's happened. He's so excited that someone who's not a sinner and not a tax collector is reaching out to him, that he wants to bring these two worlds together, this world with Jesus and this world with all of his friends, and bring them all together in one place. And so he has a party. And if you're a tax collector and a sinner, who do you probably have friends with? Other tax collectors, other sinners. And that's who's there. And what's pretty cool about Jesus is, I mean, you know, I don't know if you guys have watched, I hated those movies about Jesus when in the 70s and 80s. Jesus was like this real skinny, pale guy with like gaunt cheeks and bags under his eyes. And he was always either sad or angry. And he looked sick. And he was never smiled. I don't think that was Jesus at all. I mean, there was a movie in the like late 90s where they had a Happy Jesus TV movie, and a whole lot of Christians criticized it because he was this big 6'4", good-looking guy who grinned a lot, and they were like, that's not like Jesus. Maybe it was. It seems like he enjoyed being around people and having a party and going to banquets. And so he goes to this banquet, and mixes with these tax collectors and sinners. But, there's always a but, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who belonged to their sect complained to his disciples, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? So, the Pharisees, who were known for being really meticulous about every detail of the law, they were upset. And if you've got a New Living Translation and you look at the way they ask this question in Mark 2, the response is, the translators wrote it as, why do you eat with such scum? And that really is the gist of what they're saying. They would never eat with such people. Let me explain for a second. You're probably familiar with the Pharisees as well. The group of them, their name means separated ones. And so they really believed, or holy ones. I mean, we've got a similar notion about what holiness is. It's to be separate and to be set apart. And they said we should do that. They typically were not priests. But they wanted to keep such a high moral law. They thought that if they did that it would save the nation of Israel. And so they took a lot of the ritual purity laws from the temple, and then they applied them to their daily lives in ways that the Bible never included, in ways that God never intended. And so they viewed their table where they would eat dinner as their altar. And so the ritual purifications that the priest would go through when they were going to sacrifice and serve at the temple of the Lord, they applied that to table fellowship, to eating dinner. And if you didn't eat dinner in the same way, if you didn't wash in the same way, if you didn't use the right dishes and bowls, then you were breaking the law. And if you remember, there's a few stories in the Old Testament where a priest didn't follow the right procedures, and he died, or he was cut off from the people. Well, they're saying, hey, that's how it is with us. So if you don't wash your hands right, and if you don't use, this is a bowl that we use for dairy, and this is a bowl we use for meat. And if you mix them, you're cut off. We won't eat with you. So they wouldn't eat with anybody except other Pharisees. And in their minds, the word sinners included not only people who were murderers or liars or prostitutes or thieves, they certainly would include that, but it was also people who didn't wash their hands properly before they ate, people who didn't prepare their food correctly, people who didn't tithe the little mints and herbs that grew on their windowsill. Those people were sinners too. So when they say this, they're referring to the prostitutes and the liars and the thieves who were at Levi's party, and they were probably there. And they were also referring to the guys who just don't wash well or who don't use the right bowls. I don't know if you can really imagine having that kind of view of what sin is, but that's where these guys are. So when Jesus sits down and has a party with these guys, what he's doing is embracing and bringing into his fellowship and essentially bringing into his temple this unclean, impure group, which means he's unclean and he's impure. And so they're trying to reconcile why this is going on. Jesus answered them, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." I like what, I think it's Matthew's account where he also says, and go and learn what this means. "I desire mercy and not sacrifice." So why is it that Jesus would hang out with scum? They needed him. That's it. They needed him. They were sick, and he was a doctor. So here's the deal. I don't think any of us want to be Pharisees. I don't think that's something we strive for. And I don't think when they started this movement hundreds of years before Jesus that was in their minds either. They were trying to just do the right thing and keep themselves from being polluted by the world, which was the problem of the nation of Israel for hundreds of years. And it's what led to their destruction and their defeat over and over and over and over again. But it's really easy to become a Pharisee. When we become Christians, in our desire to be holy, in our desire to live right, in our desire to encourage others in the church, we naturally seek out people who are like us. So more and more, our circle of friends starts to be limited just to Christians. And we start ending, we end up living in this Christian bubble. We go to church with Christians. We go to small groups with Christians. We play golf and other games with Christians. We do our hobbies with Christians. We travel with Christians. We eat with Christians. We have Christian doctors and dentists. We take our Christian dogs to Christian veterinarians. At least I do. We end up isolated and insulated from the very people who need us. I saw this stat, and I didn't see a number attached to it, but what it said was that within 2 years of a person becoming a believer, almost all of their relationships are with Christians. There are no more non-Christians who are significant people in their lives. That's normal. There was a mega church that I know about, and the members had asked the leadership of the church to create a Christian Yellow Pages. And the reason for doing this is they thought, well, we've got Christian brothers and sisters who are in business. We would like to support them. We think it would help them out. It would also help us because we believe we'd be able to trust these people better. It's great. We'll create this Yellow Pages, and that's who we'll work with. And the leadership of the church said, there's absolutely no way we're doing that ever. And their reason was this: we don't want you to only be around Christians. Not that we don't want you to be around them at all. That's not what I'm saying. but we don't want that to be all year around. We want you to live life with people who are not believers. We want you to do business with people who are not believers. We want you to live around people who are not believers so that you'll be able to bring people who are not believers to Jesus. It's very easy to become a Pharisee, a separatist, even with the best of intentions. But that's not what Jesus did. At Levi's house, he got to speak to a group that would never darken the door of a synagogue and would be kicked out of the temple. Most of the tax collectors and these sinners were already excommunicated from the synagogues. He went to the irreligious, to the immoral. So I want to ask, how many of you know someone who would never darken the doors of this building? How many of you know someone who, maybe you're in a small group and you love that fellowship, but you probably couldn't get someone to come to a Bible study? So here's what I want to ask you to do. I mean, you know, Bill talked about our leadership goals earlier. So there's two goals we've got that will fit in with this. One of them is just reaching out to people in our community, which I think that's been what I've been trying to talk about for the last few weeks. The other one is about a renewed focus on small groups. And so there are other things we want to do with that renewed focus on small groups, but there's one way we could marry the two. And without having like this big evangelistic campaign, without having a set of how are we going to convince them of something when they show up? How can we throw Bibles at them when they show up? That's really effective. What if we had Levi parties? I don't know if we want to do it once a month, once a quarter, once a year. But what if we had in our small groups every once in a while? We're not going to have a Bible study. We're just going to invite some people over, have dinner and play games or watch a game or a movie or do something. I want to encourage you to think about it. We can be creative. There's lots of ways we can do this. It doesn't just have to be at someone's house. If that's too intimidating, if having, you know, inviting 35 people over to your house seems like a bit much, we could try something else. But I did hear about a dentist who did this, and in 1 year, he had a Levi party every couple of weeks. And in 1 year, he invited over 100 people to Jesus, to meet Jesus. And I mean, the comments from these folks were kind of funny. There's one that stuck out to me, and it's this one couple who said, "We didn't even know you could have this much fun sober." But I think that's what people think of us, because we've insulated ourselves from them. We've isolated ourselves from them. And they see the pale, pasty, angry, sad Jesus, and that's what they think of us. And this is what the early church did. If you flip over to Acts 2, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. Selling their possessions and goods, they gave to anyone as he had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Now, I don't want to minimize the power of the miracles and the signs and the wonders, because I think that kind of impresses me. But if you look at the ministry of Jesus, for 3 years, he was doing that everywhere he went. And think about the staying power that had with the crowd. In the end, we know how many he fed on two different occasions. There's 9,000 men. Probably 20,000 plus people. There are only maybe a couple dozen healings recorded, but there's lots of times when he would go into a town and the scripture just says he healed all their sick. So there's probably 1,000 or more people he's healed. And at the end of the 30,000 plus people that Jesus did a miracle for, and I'm not saying people who watched it, but he did it for them. When he comes back, when he's resurrected, another miracle that's just amazing, there's like 600 people in the crowd. That's it. That's the church. An amazing display of power, personal power, to 30,000 people, 600. Now, that's a great start. Obviously, it worked. But that's the power of the miracle. The power of the church was that social dynamic of living life together. There's a book that I read a while ago. I don't think anybody else read it. And it's kind of a weird book, but I guess that kind of fits. You can't see it too well. It's blown up there. I just grabbed a picture of the cover off of Amazon. So it's The Rise of Christianity. The guy who wrote it is a professor. He was a professor at the time at the University of Washington. And I was in campus ministry there, but we were about to leave, and so I never got a chance to talk to the guy. I wish I had. I've always wondered about his faith. He claimed that he was an agnostic when he wrote the book. It's interesting now. He says he's a believer, which is kind of a cool story. But after extensive research of how the church grew, and his focus was this, it was how could this obscure Jewish sect in the middle of the darkest corner of the Roman Empire in just 300 years be the dominant force in Western civilization? And it still is today. How on earth did that happen? And really, there's been no great explanation of it because people, because Western civilization is so tied to Christianity and has been for so long, I think people kind of took it for granted. But, you know, this agnostic who studies it as a sociologist says, wait a minute, how did this happen? And here's what he suggests, that this rise in Christianity was not because of mass conversions, but it was through the gradual individual conversions via social networks of family, friends, and colleagues. And this is a phrase he used, by the way, long before, social networks and smartphones and Facebook and all that. So that's not what he's talking about. It used to mean something else. But he suggested that Christianity grew because the church treated people better. That's it. They treated people better. The disenfranchised, the poor, women, the sick, slaves. At one point, he described how the church seemed to grow disproportionately during a time of plague or disease. And so what would happen is the people didn't understand germs, they didn't understand medicine really well, but they did know enough to know that if a plague started here in Reynoldsburg, the best way to live was to leave. And so people would flee. And if, Joel, if you got sick, Barb and the girls are leaving. And you're going to stay there. And that's how people acted. They just left the people behind. So if you were the sick one, you're out of luck. There's no telling how many more people died from lack of care as opposed to the disease itself. But what he noticed was that from the documentation that didn't seem to happen as much in the Christian families. The Christians didn't leave. They stayed. They took care of their sick. They took care of the church members who were sick. And so the survival rates of Christians when a plague hit a town was significantly higher than it was for non-Christians. And then here's what they also did. I mean, they didn't start clinics or anything. They didn't really know how to do that. But if they noticed that the pagans who lived next door left behind someone, the Christians would take care of that person too. And the survival rates of those people was also higher. And when they got healthy, those people almost always joined the Christian community. And often their witness would mean that the pagan family who left, they would be impacted by that as well if they didn't, you know, if they weren't really mad at them. But that's how the church grew. They treated people better. You know, for the last few weeks, we've been talking about outreach. And there is great power in evangelism. There's great power in words, in preaching, in teaching, in Bible studies, in books. I don't want to minimize that at all. I think we do need to know how to share our faith with words. But the multiplying power of the gospel is not in words. The multiplying power of the gospel is in love. Sacrificial love.